So recently there was a conference on Reformed theology in Porvoo, and at the end of that conference there was a section on eschatology. There were three different views represented in that event. There was premillennialism, which is Miska's position. Then there was amillennialism, which was represented by Mikko Sivonen from Jyväskylä's Reformed Baptist Church, and postmillennialism by Tuomas Toppila from Espoon Kotikirkko. Now, already in that sermon, people were clearly left with the impression, correct impression, that eschatology is a complicated topic. But in fact, it is even more complicated than it seemed at that event, because that was just one variable that eschatology entails. So there are other two variables that are unrelated. They are somewhat correlated between the ones that were discussed there, but it is mere correlation. So the other two variables is called preterism versus futurism, and I will not be dealing with that. It is irrelevant to what I want to preach on this Sunday. But the other variable, that is the newest one to even receive a name. So this has been a discussion throughout history, and Calvin already corrected some of the Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox understandings on this, but this didn't really have names that everyone would be able to talk the same language on, like those other two. So recently, these have been named by Craig Blazing as spiritual vision model versus new creation model. Now, Blazing coined those terms, but Michael J. Black has been probably talking most these recent years on that topic, and specifically in those terms. So here I have his new book, and as I understand, we have four copies among the leaders of this congregation. So whenever any of us has read our copy, then you will be able to borrow this book if you want. And it's also available on Amazon and in all the typical places. But I am thankful that now we have terms to discuss this last thing that has been so elusive in eschatological discussions of the past. So I will be completely ignoring the other two aspects, and I will be focusing on this last aspect, which is the thing that all those three people there agreed on. It didn't really even need to be mentioned, because as Calvinists, especially in the current day, we can be expected to hold on to new creation model. But this is to clarify how that is not just an accidental part of Calvinism, but it integrates into the whole thing, and it leads to the Protestant work ethic, among other things, that we, especially in this country, we have typically associated historically with Luther's name. But Calvin has been the most important figure in that sense in history, and not Luther. So Calvin really worked the system together, and I'm attempting to present that system in this sermon. So it is surprising that eschatology would lead to such a topic as work ethic that doesn't seem to have anything to do with it, but that is what I attempt to show. Now, as I said, there is a correlation between the topics discussed at Porvoo, and that there is a very important correlation to understand in terms of amillennialism, because it has historically been the position of the Roman Catholic Church, though they don't like that name, and the Eastern Orthodox Church. And both of those churches have also held to the spiritual vision model that is not our position here. So because that is such a massive part of church history, then spiritual vision model has been sort of assumed, and even by us Protestants, we have absorbed the imagery and the language from art and literature that is really drawing from the European Catholic background. So one important thing for us Calvinists is to recognize these attitudes that come really, that we have almost unknowingly stolen from the Catholics. And So again, amillennialism, because it is their position, it is typically very strongly associated with spiritualism model. But there are other examples. There are amillennialists that hold the new creation model. Most importantly, perhaps Anthony Hokima. But again, I will not be going into those topics, just to let you know that all combinations exist. But typically historical Calvinists are post-millennialists, and then there are, especially in Reformed Baptist churches, you find premillennialists, and the new creation model integrates to those things in a very natural way. But anyway, just to let you know that all possibilities are represented by actual people. Now there is another very important author here, and that is Randy Alcorn. So he has written a book called Heaven. That is a book intended for the layperson in church. So both of Michael J. Black's books, they are academic books. They are written to the academic level. But Randy Alcorn is a pastor, and this Heaven is written as a pastoral book for the congregationist, for the person in the congregation. So that is what I would recommend first, just see the importance for your own life, the practical things that follow from this thing, and then the theory you can read from Black if you want to. So that is a book that I absolutely recommend, and one of my absolute favorite Christian books of all time. It doesn't contain these terms, spiritual vision model and new creation model, but it is absolutely on that topic. It is arguing for the new creation model and how we should get rid of that Roman Catholic baggage that we have as Protestants. So I will start with reading Isaiah chapter 65 verses 17 to 25. Now the reason I'm doing this is that we have actually very little information, direct information, in the Bible about the eternal state that when we receive our resurrection bodies that we will live in. We have so few information there that we can actually essentially read all of it during this sermon. So this should not be a complicated topic to come to a conclusion of what that eternal state is like. But I intend to show that historically we have been confused on that for over 1,000 years with this clear and this little biblical information that should not even have left any room for misunderstandings. And those misunderstandings have come from tradition, plain and simple. Just like in the time of the Pharisees, there was the tradition of the elders, which was a very creative way of making the Bible say something completely different than it actually says. That thing has played over and over, both in the Old Covenant era and in the New Covenant era, that we invent our own traditions and overwrite what the Bible clearly says. So I will be going to the only other portion, so the only two portions in the Bible about that are specifically and explicitly about the eternal state are in Revelation and Isaiah. Both contain the words new heaven and new earth. So that is our hint that these are the texts that we should be concentrating on. So Isaiah 65. Let me turn there. And verses starting from 17. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem to be a joy, and her people to be a gladness. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people. No more shall be heard in it the sound of weeping and the cry of distress. No more shall there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not fill out his days. For the young man shall die 100 years old, and the sinner 100 years old shall be accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity, for they shall be the offspring of the blessed of the Lord, and their descendants with them. Before they call, I will answer. While they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall graze together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox, and dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. Now, obviously, this section is usually associated with the discussion of amillennialism versus premillennialism. But what we have to note either way, no matter which eschatological point of view we represent, it says, "For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth." So the topic of this section, even if it goes there through a sort of a detour, like in premillennialism, or if it's actually talking about the eternal state directly and only that, like in amillennialism, still we have to see that the topic that it itself says is the topic of this section is the new heavens and a new earth. So our image of what that is like should be based on the things that are said in this section, even if they may or may not apply to the millennium also. So let's look at the things that are mentioned here. So I counted the things that are mentioned and how many verses they all take here. So again, this is our source of information but of the eternal state. And here's the verses. Death gets 1.5 verses because one verse is divided between two subjects. So we're talking about the absence of death in 1.5 verses. We are talking about work in 2.5 verses. We are actually talking about work much more than any other topic, and this is about the eternal state. And then animals get 1 verse. And what other topics are there? There aren't really any. So does this have any resemblance on how we picture our eternal life, as we call it, in heaven? How often do we hear it discussed in the terms of work? But that is the focus of this verse, by far the biggest focus. So that was the one portion that is explicitly about new heavens and new earth. So the only other, and again, only two places in the whole Bible that are explicitly about this. So if we did not find the traditional way that we picture the eternal state in that section, then surely we would expect to find it in the other section. So I will be starting now from Revelation chapter 21, verses 24 to 26. Chapter 21, verse 24. By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it, and its gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there. They will bring into it the glory and the honor of the nations, but nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. So again, this sounds suspiciously familiar to us on this earth. It is a world that is better than what we know, but we are talking about kings. We are talking about the kings bringing the wealth of the nations. And again, remember, this is after the millennium. Everything has already happened. The resurrection has happened at this point. Nothing future, no future eschatological change is coming. And we talk about kings bringing the wealth of the nations to New Jerusalem. So again, no resemblance to a traditional imagery of heaven. And then I'll continue to the next chapter, chapter 22, verses 3 to 5. No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads, and night will be no more. They will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. So again, we're talking about reigning. Now, reigning is clearly an activity. And if we now proceed to the way that Roman Catholics traditionally picture this state, this is the exact opposite of there. These descriptions, they are full of activities that we know. They are merely sacrificed. There are better versions of it, but this is all familiar based on the life we have lived on this earth. Everything will be familiar but restored to the way it was intended to be before the fall. It will be restored to the original creation, and that is why this view is called the new creation model. So it is not a destruction of God's creation, but it is a renewal to the original state. So step by step, all the effects of the fall and sin will be reversed until we are back to the perfect creation that God described as very good. And if we have time at the end of the sermon, then I will be reading the whole portion. Last time I did not, but you will see that this is all filled with activity, and there is nothing that resembles the imagery that we are traditionally used to. So this is now the contrast to the way that for thousands of years this eternal state has been pictured in Christian art. So this book comes from the Roman Catholics, the Divine Comedy by Dante. Now, perhaps the most striking way to illustrate this will be to show the pictures in it. So compare these pictures to what I just read. So here is the very, very last illustration in the book. There's a circle of angels. There is nothing material there. This is all intended to describe spiritual, intangible things. There's a circle of angels, and that represents God there. So that is the last illustration, so it's definitely about the eternal state and no middle state in between. Then I go a little back, and I could keep doing this, and it would be the same thing. So next book, again, same theme. Here are angels, here are clouds, people standing on the cloud. And I could go on and on, and it would be the same theme, it's basically the same picture, pictured over and over again. And when I go on to read the text will match this description that is the opposite of what the Bible just said. So here, this book is in Finnish, but I have the English version made by Henry Longfellow on my tablet. So I'll be quoting there from the way the Catholics describe this eternal state. Remember, this is poetry, so this is a little cumbersome language. Upon this side, where perfect is the flower, a little remark. The flower, Dante pictures the heaven as this flower shape, where people are sitting around God in the shape of a flower. Those who were the best saints in this life get to sit the closest, and then, like a rose petal, you go away and away from the center, the more common Christian you were. So that's the imagery that he describes here. Again, this is the eternal state. This is the very last section of the book. Upon this side, where perfect is the flower, with each one of its petals, seated are those who believed in Christ who was to come. Upon the other side, where intersected with vacant spaces are the semicircles, are those who look to Christ already come. And as upon this side, the glorious seat of the Lady of Heaven and the other seats below it, such a great division make. So opposite doth that of the great John, who ever holy desert and martyrdom endured, and afterwards 2 years in hell. And under him thus to divide were chosen Francis and Benedict and Augustine, and down to us the rest from round to round. Behold now the high providence divine for one and other aspect of the faith. In equal measure shall this garden fill, and know that downward from the frank which cleaves midway the sequence of the two divisions, not by their proper merit are they seated, but another's under fixed conditions, for these are spirits one and all assoiled before they any true election had. Well canst thou recognize it in their faces, and also in their voices puerile, if thou regard them well and hearken to them. Wasn't that a whole bunch of nonsense compared to what I just read earlier from the Bible? Like, I could not basically understand any of this. This was pure word salad based on these very concrete descriptions that I just read from the only portions of the Bible that are on this topic. And also there is another interesting thing here that Dante speaks of that I didn't know this when I prepared for the Finnish sermon. So how are the absolute best saints described in this eternal state? It says, and also in their voices puerile. Now puerile means childish, and I have never ever heard in my life this used in a positive way. Basically it is a more intensified version of the word childish. But here, why would Dante describe the voices of the saints in the eternal state as the voices of children? Obviously, because he does not respect any of the maturity that we gathered in this earth. Now, again, this earth is fallen, but still we associate a deep adult voice with maturity. But here, Dante throws all of that away in the eternal state and makes everyone to have the voice of a child. Why would he do that? I will be coming to what lies the assumptions that lie behind all these things later in the sermon. But notice that how everything about what we would recognize from this world is thrown away from this imagery. It is reversed completely. That is the Catholic model of describing the eternal state. I will not be reading for lack of time the other section that I have quoted here, but it doesn't really contain anything very interesting. It's basically a list of all kinds of saints from history sitting in this rose petal state. But of note is that in none of these descriptions, nothing ever happens throughout all eternity. So to them, eternity is one static moment, everlasting moment of worship. And through all the things described here, there is not a single event, not a single happening in all these descriptions, several chapters of this in Dante. So clearly these pictures that we just read from the Bible and that we get from Catholic history, they are the complete absolute opposites of each other. The other is fully intangible. There is nothing happening, there is nothing to touch, there is nothing to do, and the other focuses on work for the eternal state. So how is it even possible that we have gotten this far from the two texts that we have on the topic? Well, the obvious answer is tradition, and that is why we are Protestants. So the historical term for what I just read from Dante is called beatific vision. So that's how this idea is known, that the eternity is one static moment where nothing happens and we are just beholding God forever. Now, one major source, historical source, that has led us to this point is what Augustine wrote early in his life, very quickly after he had just become a Christian. Because the background that he came from was a heresy called Manichaeism. Now, those guys, they worshipped angels. And it seems that Augustine, as he left that life, he was such a bad taste in his mouth for any angel talk that he wanted to get as far away from that background as possible, and in doing so he seemed to have made some errors of judgment. But the very last book that he ever wrote is in English called Redactions. So in that book he corrects some of those imbalanced things that he said in his youth. But unfortunately, the damage had already been done. because these quotes that I'm now going to read, they come from the very popular books from Augustine, City of God and On Faith and the Creed. So almost no one has read Reductions. So these quotes are what got us on the wrong track as Christendom. So here writes young Augustine about the resurrection bodies which we receive in the final state. In the case of celestial bodies, on the other hand, there is no flesh, but only those simple and lucent bodies which the apostle designates as spiritual, while some call them ethereal. So that's the other problem quote. But in Reductions, Augustine directly addresses this quote that he wrote and corrects it. And this is what he writes in that book. If this, that is the ethereality that he mentioned, be understood about bodies without the members which we now have and without substance, though incorruptible, yet of flesh, it is an error. So he says that the normal understanding of the word ethereal, which is intangible, is an error. But again, the damage had already been done at that point. Then there is another problem quote. City of God is the most popular book of Augustine, and this is what he, again, young Augustine, so this is what he writes in that book. And by this universal conflagration, the qualities of the corruptible elements which suited our corruptible bodies shall utterly perish, and our substance shall receive such qualities as shall, by a wonderful transmutation, harmonize with our immortal bodies, so that as the world itself is renewed to some better thing, it is fitly... I'm sorry, I read the wrong quote. See, this is from Reductions. I have missed the English translation of the problem quote. So this is what he corrects. So again, this is what he writes rightly. So I'll read the... I'll continue with the quote. As the world itself is renewed to some better thing, it is fitly accommodated to men, themselves renewed in their flesh to some better thing. So yeah, unfortunately I had the original problem quote, but this is what he writes about that. So he corrects his previous understanding and instead says that after the world is renewed, it is fitted to our bodies. So two corrections, but both too late. And it had affected thousands of years of how we represent the eternal state in art and worship music and so forth. Now, the first person to actually receive this glorious resurrection body is obviously the Lord Jesus Christ. So, what does he do in this resurrection body? This should also guide our understanding of what we are going to do there. So there are a few things that the Bible mentions after Jesus' resurrection. Now, he asks the disciples for something to eat. This is again the complete opposite of how we picture that eternal state. Then, that was in Luke chapter 24, verse 41. Then he cooks food for the disciples. John chapter 21, verse 10. Now, there is nothing that Jesus does that is the kind of thing that we expect based on Christian art. There is only that one mention of Jesus appearing in the room with the disciples, but even there we're not entirely sure if Jesus walked through the walls or walked through the door, the closed door, as we typically understand that verse, or if he just walked in and nobody notices until he was there. So, and that is the only thing. That is not a completely everyday thing that Jesus does. He cooks, he eats, all the descriptions in his resurrection body are of completely everyday things. So again, this should lead us to conclude that what we will be doing, our whole experience in that state will be familiar to us, but vastly improved. Then there is another good example, which is Adam before the fall. Now this is also obviously a similar thing to our new state. So what's the first thing he does? He is put to work immediately after he is created. He is made to tend the garden of Eden. So work in itself is not any part of the curse. Work existed before the fall of man. The only thing that changed in the fall of man and with the curse is that work became disagreeable. Now the world is against us while we work, and it is constantly trying to hinder our work. In the beginning, the world was easy to garden and work was pleasant, but there was still work, and so there will be in the eternal state. So as I mentioned, what could possibly be the reason for that picture to change from this book into this book? Well, there's a pretty good case to be made that a very old heresy, probably the oldest heresy and most stubborn heresy, called Gnosticism, lies beyond that. Gnosticism actually existed even before Christianity. Now, there were some very creative ways to integrate it with the ideas of Christianity, and there were two notable people historically. The first one was called Marcion, and the second one was called Valentinius, but these ideas predated Christianity. So Gnosticism says that matter itself is evil. That is the most fundamental claim of Gnosticism. There's a vast number of religious details, but that is where everything stems from, that it is not merely that the world in its current state is cursed like we believe, but they believed and continue to believe, because this heresy still exists and is very strong even today, they believe that matter itself is inherently evil and cannot be redeemed. And this is why if they imagine a good world, they must imagine it a completely intangible spiritual world. And there seems to be a very good case to be made that we have absorbed, because Gnosticism, again, it has made so many attempts to integrate itself with Christianity. There's a good case to be made that they have been able to inject some of those ideas, and that is why we, if we imagine the absolute perfect world that will last forever, we are tempted to imagine it as something intangible and pure spirit. But this is a Gnostic idea, and we must get rid of it. It has nothing to do with the Bible, and the Bible always speaks of the creation in the complete opposite way to that. So, as the Protestant Reformation happened, obviously, at that time, every Protestant thought that, okay, now all the historical errors are immediately fixed and put right, and we can put Catholicism to rest. But there were problems, and there were especially problematic branches right from the beginning. So obviously Lutheranism and Calvinism are the branches that we are familiar with, but there is also the radical branch of Reformation that still exists in small groups. The Mennonites are probably the most important group that is pure radical Reformation, and the common factor to all such groups is that they completely isolate to their own communes. They do not even want to go outside them unless they absolutely have to stay alive. Otherwise, they repudiate everything about the world. Technology, like, they isolate as far as it is possible to isolate. And this was the feature of that original radical Reformation. So that has survived to this day. But there is a little bit watered-down version of that radical Reformation that takes some of those ideas but doesn't go that far into isolation. And we call that view pietism. Now, as the radicals thought that it is always evil and always a problem to participate in the secular world in any way, even work, and it is just a necessary evil to stay alive, pietism does not go that far. So a pietist will be able to work in a secular job. But what the pietist thinks is that none of those things that pertain to the tangible world can have any religious or spiritual value. They are just means to an end. They are to keep you alive so that you can go to the Sunday service. And the work in this view only has utilitarian value. In this view, it can never be worship in itself to commit work. So this is much more common even in these days. So Methodists, for example, are a good example of a denomination that was founded as a pietist denomination. Pentecostals also are a strange mixture of charismaticism and pietism, but they are denominations that are entirely founded on this principle. And when we as Calvinists see that work, just ordinary cleaning, being a clerk at the store, all these things can actually have religious value, have value in the sight of God and not just utilitarian to keep us alive, then understandably we may seem like we preach prosperity gospel to some. And there have been these criticisms about us even in this country. But now, we might be tempted to laugh at this idea, but as I will quote from Herman Bavinck, that most of the structure for this sermon is based on, this has indeed been historically a problem among Calvinists. There have been those who have taken this idea and run with it all the way to prosperity theology. And my message here is that we have to keep two things in good balance, because the pietists, they abandon one side of the matter entirely and they just run completely to the one side of the road. But and the prosperity gospel preachers run to the opposite side of the road. Both are ignoring one important side of what it is to serve God and what it is to be a full man who is living to prepare for that new creation that will be here one day. So it has been recognized as a real historical danger that you will just get unbalanced on one side or the other. And I have some historical quotes to read on that. Now, how does the pietist understanding, how does that happen? Well, there are some verses in the Bible, especially in our translations, that make that error somewhat understandable. Because there's a problematic way in which we have historically translated the two separate words, ion and cosmos, Greek words. We have both translated them with the English word world. And that gets us our thinking into the wrong track. Because ion really, it means age. Even the English word eon is just direct translation of that word. And nobody would understand the word eon as meaning the material world. But when we translate that word from the Greek as world, then we get the completely wrong idea of what the passage is talking about. So when for example in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 verse 10 it says that you must come out of the world, we might expect the word cosmos to be there based on what we read. So we must come out of the material existence and go into a monastery or something. But what it says is that we must come out of the age. And it is a reference to this present evil age, as the Bible says, especially at that time when all the known branches of the Old Covenant Judaism, namely Pharisees, Sadducees, the Essenes and Zealots, there was nothing that was really right. Some of them were more wrong than others, and Pharisees were theologically pretty solid, but then Pharisees had the tradition of the elders, which introduced spiritual pride into their system, and now Pharisees usually exclusively used as a pejorative word. So that was how bad the situation was at the time, that no group with a name was actually breaching what the Jewish scriptures said. There were just individuals who God had preserved, but the situation was very dire. And in that historical context, Paul commands to come out of this age. In other words, of all the attitudes that go along with that with everything, with all the religious corruption that had entered into Judaism at that time. It does not absolutely mean that you must come out of the world the way that the Radical Reformation attempted to do. Now, in modern times, some translations have started improving this, making it more clear when it is speaking of eon and when it's speaking of cosmos, but this continues to be a problem. So please understand that if the Bible says something negative about the world, it is almost certain that you will find the word eon behind it. It is not talking negatively about material existence. So now, with that background of what the historical problem was, how we understood eschatology wrong, and how we Calvinists have traditionally understood it as a renewed creation, I will now finally go to the topic that I intended to preach on, which is the Protestant work ethic. Now, in this country, when we are speaking in Finnish, we almost always don't say Protestant work ethic, we say Lutheran work ethic. And even I myself thought that this was something that was invented and exclusive to Luther, because those were the words that I always heard. I was actually surprised in preparing this sermon that in the English-speaking world it is known as the Protestant work ethic. I didn't find one single Google hit with Lutheran work ethic, and whenever they directed me to Protestant work ethic, who did I find behind it? I found Calvin. I did not find one single mention of Luther with those words. So it is actually Calvin who developed this whole understanding. And there is a certain quote that is wrongly associated with Luther, that people think this so-called Lutheran work ethic comes from. Now, it turns out this is the part about Christian shoes not being shoes with crosses drawn on them, but well-made shoes. Luther didn't actually say this quote. It is a shorthand version of something that he did say. So here is the whole quote from Luther on this topic that can actually be sourced, that can be documented where it really came from. So this quote that I'm about to read describes the entire so-called Lutheran work ethic. Quote, "The prince should think, Christ has served me and made everything to follow him. Therefore, I should also serve my neighbor, protect him and everything that belongs to him. That is why God has given me this office, and I have it that I might serve him. That would be a good prince and ruler. When a prince sees his neighbor oppressed, he should think, that concerns me. I must protect and shield my neighbor. The same is true for shoemaker, tailor, scribe, or reader. If he is a Christian tailor, he will say, I will make these clothes because God has bidden me do so that I can earn a living, so that I can help and serve my neighbor. When a Christian does not serve the other, God is not present. That is not Christian living." Unquote. So that is what Luther actually said on the topic, and the mention for shoemaker obviously led to the shortened and misattributed version of this quote. Now, the interesting thing here that Luther says is that he gives value to work, normal, ordinary work, that was not there before in the Roman Catholic background. Because Roman Catholicism and work were built on a philosophy called monasticism. So that relates to monasteries. So the idea was that secular work, the kind that a shoemaker would do, only gets its value by keeping the person alive and able to donate to the church. So Luther here is saying that is not the only thing, but you can also serve your neighbor and in that way serve God with your normal work. So this is already an improvement, because what Catholics said, that the only work done in a monastery is of religious significance. That was the whole point of why monasteries were built. So that is where you could really work for God and for God to appreciate your work for what it is, but no other work could have that kind of a value. Now, this is not to say that I look down on monasteries of old, because Bibles, before we had printing press, they were copied in monasteries. So they were extremely important places to keep the biblical text in availability to us, so that we can now find in any building probably at least one Bible, and here dozens of them. So that is very much thanks to those people. But when the printing press was invented, was there really any need for a monastery anymore? Well, that it entirely depends on whether you believe this idea that it is a special place of sanctifying the work you do, so that now it has work in itself. If we abandon that idea, like Luther abandoned it, then there is no point for that system anymore, and now we come to the point that we serve our neighbor with our work. So this was a historical improvement. But my point is that it was just one improvement. It was just an observation that doesn't really integrate to the rest of theology of Lutheranism. It is really Calvinism that can give grounds to understand why work has value as service to God. And that is because we are preparing for that eternal state where work will exist. And as I said, it was actually the focus of the Isaiah passage that I just read. So now that we can mature, we can gain skills, and all those skills, they will be relevant there because it will be a tangible existence. It is very understandable that if you have the picture like Dante had of a completely immaterial heaven, then why would you give any value to work? Because nothing like that will ever be done again. But we have a completely different kind of understanding there, and hence the things that are done here, the skills and maybe even items, Randy Alcorn argues actually in the book Heaven that we might be able to take some art, some actual art that we made here, for example, to the eternal state. Now that is speculation, but the point is that if the eternal state is like that, then that gives an explanation for why the work that we do here has value, and not just for the part where it is serving our neighbor. So this new creation model, it focuses on the continuity in the moment from when the effects of the fall are reversed. That again, in that everything will be recognizable to us. Now let's consider, as a contrast to us, let's consider the angels. For example, the angels mentioned in Revelation who worship God day and night. They were the kind of beings who were created for that kind of existence. Now obviously God would have created those kind of beings to be the kind of beings who would enjoy that existence, but we are not created that way. We are created tangible. Now when I, for example, read that portion from Dante, I think all of us have to admit that we did not really, in our heart of hearts, desire that kind of existence. And we might be afraid to even acknowledge to ourselves that we didn't. But we were not created as the kind of beings to enjoy that existence. And that is why we yearn for a different kind of existence. We yearn for adventure. We yearn for activities, real social interaction with other peoples. And this is exactly what both of those portions describe that state to be like. So, as you see, the way you value work really has a strong connection to the eschatology you have, because in one eschatology you can explain why the work has value, and in the other you can't. Now, why did Calvin do better in this than Luther? Well, this is speculation, but I think it is because they had different kind of jobs to do, or at least perceived themselves to have different kind of jobs. Luther was founding a state church, actually whole Europe. He was founding a system, a new way of Christianity for all of Europe, and that was a major focus of organizing those kind of state churches. How exactly we organize the Sunday service, what kind of church hierarchy we have, and so forth. He didn't have that much time to think about systematizing theology and figuring out how all those things work together. Now, Calvin, on the other hand, was not knowingly even beginning any kind of movement. He was paid to be the pastor of his church in Geneva. So Calvin really had all the day, and also paid to write the book Institutes of Christian Theology. So he had all day to think about these things. So Calvin was a systematizer because that is what he was paid for. Whereas Luther was intentionally starting a new political movement, and it is understandable that he didn't have the kind of time to do theology that Calvin did. But we, all the Calvinists that we are, we should also try to integrate these things with ourselves and see our work with these eyes. And if we're in a job that is not very highly valued by this work, by this world, we should understand that all those jobs still give these opportunities, that all the cleaners and all the people that we see as ordinary, they are able to serve God in all this. So this is why I exhort everyone to read theology. Things connect in surprising ways when you see how the theology kind of flows organically into the practice and the attitudes that you express in everyday life. So I have one very practical example here of how this decision came to a point for someone that was suddenly thrown into the deep end of theology, trying to decide what to do with her life. Now, in the Finnish sermon, I asked her permission to recount the story. The person is Minna Sundberg from Jyväskylä congregation. And she's a comic artist, and she has made a comic that recounts all these things and all the kind of spiritual battles that she had converting from atheism to Christianity. So I'm not telling anything new here, but this is an excellent example of how you have to make a life-changing decision based on theology that you have regarding work. So here's the situation she faced. She was already publishing a very profitable comic series, profitable even maybe on worldwide scale and not just Finnish scale. The problem, however, was that the work was heavily inspired by paganism, which is understandable because she did it while she was an atheist. The comic doesn't really preach paganism, it doesn't do anything like that, but it certainly is inspired and it has pagan gods in it and so forth. Now again, this comic series was the financial source of income for all of her life. If she stopped doing it, then like that sort of income would immediately disappear. So this was a momentous decision, like what to do about this comic series now that she's a Christian. Now, there are three options that she could have taken at this point. Now obviously what she really wanted to do with her life was to make Christian comics, which she in fact is doing right now, and I wholeheartedly recommend that you read them. You can read them for free in the internet, and I'll give the link in the description portion of the YouTube video for the sermon. But anyway, so here she is having to make a decision about what to do in this situation. Now there are three realistic options and a fourth option that I don't see as realistic, but it's theoretically on the table. Option number one is that she just continues the old comic because it makes just that much money, and it is, chances are exceedingly low that she will ever be able to replicate the financial success of that comic. It is Stay Still, Stand Silent, the name if I remember correctly. Stand Still, Stay Silent, yes. So just continue that and use it in the utilitarian way to support her, to make the money. And the Catholic thinking would be very tempted for this option because they don't see work as having any real value either way. So make the most money that you can, and then you can provide the value from being able to help others with more money and donate to the church and so forth. So that's option number one. Continue with the comic, but she knew that doing it anymore would not really satisfy her now that she understands the world so much better, now that she's a Christian. So it would just become drudgery to continue that. But it would certainly be an option. And the Catholic kind of thinking would lean on that option. Now the complete opposite option would be to just absolutely get rid of that comic. Just pull it all out of all of the stores, because you'd see it as being tainted by any inclusion of paganism, even if it's not trying to persuade the reader of paganism. But the pietistic thinking would be very much tempted to this option, because again it sees the whole world as evil. This comic could not have had spiritual significance to begin with, and now that if you introduce any elements of paganism, now it's no longer a neutral piece of work, but now it's actually an evil piece of work and must be destroyed. So if you're a pietist, you would not see the value in its art quality, in its storytelling quality. All of that would be completely neutral, and now the pagan element would poison the whole project, and you would have to abandon it altogether and start something new. So that would be the opposite option. And then there's the middle option, which she actually took. So now, because she became immediately a Calvinist when she converted to Christianity, here's how she actually saw the situation with the comic. There was the art quality and storytelling quality there that was undeniable to both herself and to others. The feedback was always consistently very good about it. So since now all of those things do have value, then that leads to the comic having both the problems in terms of the paganism it contains and a real actual spiritual value in terms of the art quality. So this now, again, three options, and what she did was that she just made it really sure to any customer that the customer knows what he's purchasing. So the Christian comics and this one are not sold in the same stores. In the website there is a clear warning that this comic she no longer can fully stand behind, because it has these things, and she kind of lays out what problems there are now that the customer is able to make an informed decision. And I have actually purchased the electronic version of that, even though it is available for free. So I really appreciate what's contained in it, but you have to understand that it contains strong pagan and horror elements, and it's definitely not for children. But it is still there for sale, and anyone who knows to go to that store to buy it will know exactly what he's getting. And then the Christian comics are completely separated and sold by a different store. So again, complete, now obviously taking this turn, her income collapsed, that's predictable. But she has been still able to sustain her current standard of living, which is not very high, so it worked out well, but it might not have worked. And just imagine if she went with a pietist idea of just throwing out her only source of income at that point and just dove into abject poverty for absolutely no reason. So this is how important eschatology and theology can be, that you can make a very horrible decision because you think the world works in a different way than it really does. And the things that God values are different than have been taught to you perhaps all your life. So again, my exhortation is read theology, because you will... It may be a surprising situation when theology is suddenly forced upon you, and then it might be too late to start reading it. Now, as I said, there are two possible errors, two opposite ways that the Calvinist can go wrong, and I said that this has been an actual historical problem and not just a theoretical problem. So here are some quotes from the book that served as the basis for the structure of this sermon. So these quotes are from Herman Bavinck, and here's the first one. He's speaking of pietism. Now again, pietism should be the sort of enemy philosophy to his Calvinist position. So we might expect that he's just will see nothing good coming from pietism. But this is what he actually writes about it. This movement gives evidence of an appreciation and concern for the one thing needful, which is only too often absent from us in the busy rush of contemporary life. So he actually expresses appreciation for pietism in that at least it is protected from the temptation of prosperity theology by, well, going too far into the one direction, but at least it forces you to keep your mind on the spiritual. You're just keeping it there exclusively, and you are not growing up to be the full mature man that you could have been when you finally enter that eternal kingdom. But he does see value in it. And the reason he sees value in it, that he says that he has actually personally witnessed Calvinists who have gone to the trap of essentially prosperity theology, even though they would not express it that way, but they have started to live their lives as if they were proponents of prosperity gospel. So they just give themselves completely to work. Again, the work has value, but this is not the only thing that has been commanded to us. We are commanded to learn to be disciples in the church, and we are commanded to evangelize. There are all kinds of responsibilities. So work is good, but if you give your life wholly to it, then you become a stunted person, just like that you would become stunted if you just threw your life at pietism. So he acknowledges that there is a danger, and we must constantly focus, constantly be making recount of our lives, that if we're in danger of erring on one side or the other, we must not neglect the spiritual responsibilities that we have, and we must not think that the work we do could ever be of any spiritual good. And so, how does this in real life, what kind of things follow? Let's think of art, and let's think of items. Now, like the good example of shoes that Luther gave. Now, the shoe does have a function, but can a shoe also be beautiful? Can a shoe also be a work of art at the same time? Well, yes, obviously it can. But if you have gone too far into the pietism, you will only see the practical value in it, and you will ignore the artistic quality in both items that we use for everyday things, then as shoes, and you will also ignore any value in art. You will not almost certainly become an artist if you're a pietist. You could see no value in that kind of life, of giving yourself into that kind of life. But as Calvinists, the art is a very life of art, or life of making items that involve art and beauty, is a very legitimate way, a very legitimate path for your life to take. Because all these things have value, and they are the same kind of things that we will be making in the eternal state. Now, I have taken so long that I have to discard all the optional parts that I have for this sermon, so I will lead us in our prayer now. Father in heaven, please help us maintain this balance in our lives. Please help us understand that all these things connect, that we should be thinking of eternal things, but the eternal things connect to our everyday decisions. And we are constantly tempted both by the world and our spiritual enemies to err on one side or the other. So always, every day, let help us to see our lives for how they are really going, on whether we are erring on one side or the other. Please help us find good theology and find good teachers so that we are not given an imbalanced view of the world and imbalanced values, and maybe that would even lead us to despise our fellow man who has chosen a different kind of a path for his life. There are so many paths that are available to us to give value when we understand that your creation, the matter itself, there is nothing wrong with it and it will be merely renewed. We can go, we can dedicate ourselves to the right life of a pastor, for example, who will mostly be dealing with spiritual things, but we can also dedicate our lives to creating things of beauty. Both are truly and genuinely valuable in your sight. So when we encounter people who have chosen a different kind of life than we have, let us see these people with your eyes, and let us not be biased towards the kind of decisions that we have made ourselves. We are always dependent on the guidance and providence of the Holy Spirit to keep us on the right track. This has been recognized for centuries, and this have been lived both in good examples and bad examples. So help us be good examples in this present time that is, where spiritual error is so common. And let us be diligent in trying to correct these things and bring a new appreciation for art and things of beauty into this world, an appreciation that has been neglected for so long by these wrong turns that Christendom has taken through the years. We are so few here, so we are entirely dependent on your help, Father, and your providence in accomplishing any of those things. But first of all, let us guard our own hearts so that no spiritual pride would enter in, so that we would value the kind of decisions that we have made. Let us see our fellow believers the way you see them, all part of the same family, all your children, serving in all different capacities and all different ways. These things I pray in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.